two AA readings. We're going to read the 12 steps first, and Gigi has that for us. Gigi, come on up, girl. Presentation for the first ever history roundup this morning or this afternoon is a lady that I've gotten to know this week. She doesn't mince words. She's kind of direct about what I love. It's just right there. She gives yes or no answers, you know, so that's a wonderful thing. We're going to have a blast today learning about the history of the women in the big book. And for that, let's welcome Nancy. Woo! Of course, Nancy has a bar stool up here, right? Come on, my darling.
Right at home. Thank
you're all set, girl, and there's your when you're ready.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Nancy Carvin, and I am an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is May 24th, 1972. I want to thank Beth, our hostess with the most, as she's been fantastic, and her baby Shannon for showing Carol and me around. It's been great. And thank you, Jonathan, for inviting me. I really appreciate it. And all of you who are in here interested in AA history, this is just incredible. So I was asked to do a reading from the big book, and this is one that I struggled with for so long, because I had trouble with it. It took me 4 years. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people, or presently may be, has to be smashed. So, and again, my name is Nancy. I am an alcoholic from Galt, California. That's about 25 miles south of Sacramento. Now you all know about Galt. My mission is to put Galt on the map. And I've been interested in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous since May 24th, 1972. I wanted to know how it started, who started it, where did it start, when did it start, all of that. Right after getting the big book and the 12 and the 24-hour day book, my next book was AA Comes of Age. And the stories in the big book tell a lot about our history, plus they have had a huge impact on my own sobriety. So let's start with a little background of history in AA. And thanks to Bob Kay for the following information. A huge shift has occurred over the years in our way the culture views alcoholics. Definitely since the 1930s, the lack of knowledge and confusion about alcoholism remains, however extensive gains have been made. There is ample reason for gratitude. There, you know, we haven't completely got there, but we're a lot farther along than we were. The first efforts of bringing women into the AA fellowship did not bode well. There was a rigid double standard in the 1930s and a hostile prejudice against women alcoholics. They experienced a much greater disgrace than men, and nice women did not drink to excess. Because of society's views, women had a much harder time admitting that they had a drinking problem. The first female members of Alcoholics Anonymous had to fight for not only for their own sobriety, but for acceptance in AA and respectable society. It was rough, except for the wives of highly successful men. They were automatically regarded as promiscuous, disgraced, and generally unredeemable women. They disliked being classed with beggars, tramps, asylum inmates, prisoners, queers, plain crackpots, and, of course, fallen women. And did you notice Frank Sinatra's picture there? And I'm sure younger people have no idea who Frank Sinatra was. Some of the men got drunk and came back without much attention. But female alcoholics seem to cause more upheaval, and their presence in early meetings caused stormy debates. Boy meets girl on AA campus raised many an eyebrow. Women were the most unwelcome minority in AA's olden days. Dr. Bob didn't know how to handle them and felt that the program would not work for women. However, he did help several. According to Bill Wilson, whole groups got into uproars and a number of people got drunk. We trembled for AA's reputation and for its survival. And he recalled that explosions took place around out-of-bound romances. Imagine that. Hold on just a second. Let me put this up a little better. One of the first women was so bad that she wasn't allowed in the homes and was thrown out of AA by the wives. But she did eventually get sober. She worked with children and moved to Florida, where she made a lot of money in real estate. However, she never returned to AA because of the initial rejection. Women were labeled nymphomaniac, if you can imagine that, and looked upon as trouble by both the men and the women. The saying, "Behind every skirt is a slip," was born of this attitude. The concept of men helping men and women helping women evolved as a means of AA self-preservation prior to experience proving it unwise for the newcomer's sake. Others came from the opposite end of the social strata. There's a brief mention of an Indian waitress and an early member woman who sought help but was thrown out of AA's by the wives. She was so bad that they wouldn't allow her in their homes. This is part one of a two-part presentation, and I've chosen six women from the first and second editions because they were our women pioneers. And I only talk on the women of the first two editions because we lost the copyright for those two. And people have asked me, well, why don't you do more on the third and fourth? Well, that would be infringing on a copyright, and I'm not going to do that. So Eleanor Roosevelt said to do something every day that scares you, so here it is. I need a drink. Water. Our first story is about a trailblazer for women in AA. That would be Florence Rankin, A Feminine Victory, New York City, on the original manuscript, page 217 of the first edition. Although Jane Sturtevant got sober February 1937 in Akron, Florence was the first woman to get sober in New York, even for a short time. She came to AA in September of 1937. She had several slips, but was sober over a year when she wrote her story for the Big Book. Florence wrote, "When the idea was first presented to me that I was an alcoholic, my mind just simply refused to accept it. Horrors! How disgraceful! What humiliation! How preposterous! But I have reached the source of help." It must have been difficult for Florence being the only woman. She prayed for inspiration to tell her story in a way that would give other women the courage to seek the help that she had been given. She was the ex-wife of a man that Bill Wilson had known on Wall Street, and she thought the cause of her drinking would be removed when she and her husband were divorced. She wrote, "Oh, I had them all down, all the excuses, letter perfect. Reasons, justifications. What I did not know was that I was being destroyed by selfishness, self-pity, and resentment." But it was Florence's ex-husband who took Lois Wilson to visit her at Bellevue. Bill and Lois got her out of Bellevue, and she stayed in their home for a time. But after she left their home, she stayed with other members of the fellowship, including Ruth Hawk. Florence wrote, "I had been taught to realize that there is a God and to love him. But though I had been taught all these things, I'd never learned them." She said, "Bill put it to me this way. You admit that you made a mess out of things, trying to run them your way. Are you willing to give up? Are you willing to say it? Here it is, God, all mixed up. I don't know how to unmix it. I'll leave it to you." At one point, she was all alone and felt like drinking. She read the Bible and prayed. But she said, "I didn't say I must not take that drink because I owe it to so-and-so not to. I didn't say I won't take that drink because I'm strong enough to resist temptation. I didn't say I must not or I will not at all. I simply prayed and read. And in half an hour, I got up and was absolutely free of the urge to drink. But I know absolutely that the moment that I close my channels with sorrow for myself or being hurt by or resentful toward anyone, I am in horrible danger. I know that my victory is none of my human doing. I know that I must keep myself worthy of divine help. And the glorious thing is this, that I am free, I am happy, and perhaps I'm going to have the blessed opportunity of passing it on. I say this in all reverence. Amen." In part due to Florence having been sober for more than a year, 100 Men was discarded as the name for the big book. She spoke up and said, "Oh, what about me? I'm a woman." They changed it. She moved to Washington, D.C. and tried to help Fitz Mayo, whose story in the big book is Our Southern Friend. After sobering up in New York, he started AA in Washington, D.C. And she married an alcoholic she met there who unfortunately did not get sober. And sadly, Florence started drinking again, disappeared. And Fitz Mayo found her in the morgue. Despite her relapse and death from alcoholism, Florence helped pave the way for the many women who followed. She was in Washington by the time Marty Mann, the next woman to arrive in New York, entered the program. Marty only met her once or twice, but Florence's story in the big book no doubt encouraged Marty. This next lady helped the world view alcoholism as an illness and not a moral issue. Marty Margaret Mann. Women suffer too. New York City. She's in the second, third, and fourth editions. While Marty was not the first woman to come to AA, she was the first to stay sober and gain a great length of sobriety. Marty's first date of sobriety was April 11th, 1939. She attended her first meeting at Bill W.'s home in Brooklyn on April 13th, 1939. Marty came from a wealthy Chicago family. She attended the best boarding schools and a finishing school in Europe and traveled extensively. A popular debutante, she made her debut in 1927. Wow, it's almost 100 years ago, after which she eloped with John B. of New Orleans. Marty said of him, "He was one of the most attractive men I've met, interesting, traveled with a keen mind. His family was prominent socially, and he was the town's worst drunk." They were both high on alcohol when they eloped. Later, a church service was held in New Orleans, and Marty, whose alcoholism was not far progressed at the time, could not put up with John's drinking behavior, and they were divorced in 1928. Marty revealed, "My divorce coincided with my father's bankruptcy, and I went to work in 1928, casting off all allegiances and responsibilities to anyone other than myself." She moved in fast living circles and was known for her capacity to drink without apparent effect. For the next 10 years, she did whatever she wanted to do. For greater freedom and excitement, she went abroad to live and ran a successful photojournalism business. Headstrong and willful, rushed from pleasure to pleasure. But her alcoholism got out of hand, and she was soon in real trouble and attempted suicide twice. She tried jumping out of a window, and I think it was a 2 or 3 story high in England. It really did a lot of damage, but she survived. She came home to America, broke and desperate. Things got even worse. Marty said, "When my friends said I was drinking too much, they were no longer my friends. Hangovers began to assume monster proportions, and a morning drink become an urgent necessity. Drink had become more important than anything else. It no longer gave me pleasure. It merely dulled the pain, but I had to have it." Let's hear what Marty has to say from 1960 at the International Convention in Long Beach, California. Go ahead, Carol. Thank you, Marty. She said, "I was a hypersensitive, shy, idealistic, and disillusioned cynic. That protective armor turned into prison walls, locking me in loneliness and fear. I was an inwardly frightened, outwardly defiant woman who desperately needed the prop of alcohol to keep going. I couldn't be comfortable with any kind of people without drinking." In 1939, she was convinced she was having a serious mental breakdown. She was admitted as a charity patient to Blythewood Sanitarium in Greenwich, Connecticut. Her psychiatrist, Dr. Harry Thibault, gave her a manuscript of the book Alcoholics Anonymous to read. It was a thick 8.5 by 11 inch, a multi-lift document with red cardboard covers held together with cord, and the cover was blank, anonymous. After reading the first few chapters, she said, "I wasn't the only person in the world who felt and behaved like this. I wasn't mad or vicious. I was a sick person. I was suffering from an actual disease that had a name and symptoms, like diabetes, cancer, or TB. She exclaimed to her buddy Granny, a fellow patient, "We're not alone anymore." Dr. Thibault persuaded her to attend her first AA meeting at 182 Clinton Street in Brooklyn, New York. At the time, there were only 2 AA groups in the entire United States. God, how fortunate we are today. "I went to a meeting to see for myself this group of freaks or bums who had done this thing. I went trembling into a house in Brooklyn filled with strangers and found I had come home at last to my own kind." She rebelled at any thought of religion until a personal crisis filled her with righteous, raging anger. She was going to get drunk to show them. Then she read a sentence from the book on her bed that said, "We cannot live with anger." She wrote, "The walls crumbled. The lights came on, and this wasn't religion. This was freedom. Freedom from anger and fear. Freedom to know happiness and love." that feeling of impending disaster began to dissolve, and I would put into practice the 12 steps. It worked. In 1945, Marty became inspired with the desire to eliminate the stigma and ignorance regarding alcoholism and encourage viewing it as a disease. She believed that alcoholism runs in the family and that education of the disease was essential. Marty was a visionary and a pioneer who took on an unpopular cause during an era when women were to remain silent. With the encouragement and support of Bill W., Marty Mann founded the National Council on Alcoholism. That's where I first called for help. She utilized the Yale School of Alcoholic Studies under E.M. Jelinek to give legitimacy to the disease concept and educate the general public on alcoholism. In part because of Marty Mann's life work, alcoholism began to be seen less as a moral issue and more of a health issue. Marty influenced alcoholism legislation at the state and national levels. She got out there. In the 1950s, famous journalist and newscaster Edward R. Murrow included Marty Mann on his list of the 10 greatest Americans. Does anybody other than me remember Edward R. Murrow? Hey, good, I'm not alone. She was on the first board of directors at High Watch Farm, the world's first recovery center founded upon the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. Despite several relapses during her first year and a half, Marty succeeded in becoming sober by 1940. She had a brief relapse nearly 20 years later from alcoholic bitters that she heard Sam Houston had used to curb his alcoholism. And due to her widespread fame and anonymity breaking, she was reluctant to admit that she had had a slip, and many people covered up this fact for her. Around 1964, she admitted that she drank and began going back to meetings and being active in the public once more, and she never drank again. Marty Mann's public admission of her own alcoholism, her successful experience with AA, and her encouragement of others, especially women, to get help contributed greatly to AA's growth. She exclaimed, "My greatest thrill of accomplishment is from the knowledge that I have played a part in the new happiness achieved by countless others like myself. I can say many times daily, 'Thy will be done, not mine,' and mean it." She was the first lesbian member of Alcoholics Anonymous at a time when the gays and lesbians were not accepted by society. Her longtime lesbian partner was Priscilla Peck, once a glamorous art director at Vogue magazine and the fifth woman that Marty brought into AA. To protect the work that she was doing during a period of anti-gay bias, Marty never revealed her lesbianism except to her, to Bill W., who was her sponsor, and other close friends. She resumed her maiden name and sometime thereafter started to identify herself as Mrs. Marty M. This title helped her to cover up her sexual orientation, and she never remarried. While some men may have felt threatened by such a strong woman, Bill supported her work and went out of his way to encourage her. Marty said the 12 steps gave her more than sobriety. They gave her a glimpse at something she never had known before, a peace of mind and a sense of being comfortable with herself and with the world in which she lived, a sense of growth, both emotional and spiritual. Mrs. Marty Mann died of a stroke at age 75 on July 22, 1980, and she was sober. And this pioneer lady became an informal case study in Alcoholics Anonymous for her doctor. Sylvia Kaufman, The Keys of the Kingdom, Chicago, Illinois. She's on page 304 in the second and third editions and 268 in the fourth. This worldly lady helped to develop AA in Chicago. Anybody from Chicago here? One, good. Formerly, now Texas. And thus passed her keys to many. According to member list index cards kept by the Chicago group, Sylvia's date of sobriety was September 13th, 1939. Because of slips by Marty Mann, Sylvia may have been the first woman to achieve long-term sobriety. Sylvia was raised in a good environment with loving and conscientious parents and given every advantage like Marty. She went to the best schools, summer camps, resort vacations, and travel. She had her first drink at 16 and loved what it did for her. She was from the roaring 20s, that age of the flapper and the it girl. She married at 20, had two children, and was divorced at 23. This gave her a good excuse to drink. By 25, she had developed into an alcoholic. Sylvia said that drink did something for me or to me that was different from the way it affected others. She began making the rounds of doctors in the hope that one of them might find a cure for her accumulating ailments, preferably something that could be removed surgically. Of course, all they found was an unstable woman, undisciplined, poorly adjusted, and filled with nameless fears. Most of the doctors prescribed sedatives and advised rest and moderation, whatever that is. By the ages of 25 and 30, she tried everything. She moved to Chicago, thinking that a new environment would help. She tried all sorts of things to control her drinking, the beer diet, the wine diet, timing, mixing, measuring, spacing of drinks, trying them mixed, unmixed, drinking only when gay, drinking when depressed. Nothing worked. The next 3 years saw Sylvia in sanitariums. She wanted to die but had lost the courage to try. She remarked, "I was 33 years old and my life was spent. I was drinking in sheer desperation, alone and locked behind my own door. My fear fed a growing conviction that before long it would be necessary for me to be put away in some institution. She felt shame and fear with no complete escape any longer except oblivion. Just wipe it out." There was one doctor who did not give up on her. Like all the doctors of his day, he had been taught that the alcoholic was incurable and should be ignored. With all the alcoholics, they could only give temporary relief, and in the last stages, not even that. Alcoholics were a waste of the doctor's time and the patient's money. Nevertheless, there were a few doctors who saw alcoholism as a disease and felt that the alcoholic was a victim over something for which they had no control. Sylvia's doctor tried everything he could think of, including having her go to Mass every morning at 6 a.m. and performing menial labor for her charity patients. The doctor apparently had the intuitive knowledge that spirituality and helping others just might be the answer. In 1939, this doctor heard of the book Alcoholics Anonymous and wrote to New York for a copy. After reading it, he tucked it under his arm and called on Sylvia. That marked the turning point of her life. He must have studied the book carefully because he took its advice. The doctor explained that alcohol was no respecter of sex or background, but that most of the alcoholics he had encountered had better than average minds and abilities. Of course we do. Just ask any of us. He gave her the cold, hard facts about her condition, that she would either die of acute alcoholism, develop a wet brain, or have to be put away permanently. Then he told her of a handful of people in Akron and New York who seemed to have worked out a technique for arresting their alcoholism. He asked her to read the book. Sylvia remarked, "I stayed up all night reading that book. For me, it was such a wonderful experience. It explained so much I had not understood about myself. And best of all, it promised recovery if I would do a few simple things and be willing to have the desire to drink removed." Here was hope. Perhaps I could find freedom and peace and be able again to once again call my soul my own. Her doctor asked her to talk with a man who was experiencing success using this plan. This was Earl Treat. His story in the big book was he sold himself short. Earl was the Mr. T to whom she refers in her story. He's also the one who helped Bill W. with the traditions. Sylvia said, "I was ready and willing to go into the interior of the African jungles, if that's what it took to find what these people had. They seemed to have all the ingredients for successful living." Earl suggested that she visit Akron. According to Bill Wilson, she got off to a slow start there and also may have been a pill addict. She took a lot of little white pills, which she claimed were saccharin. And no one could quite understand why she was so rubber-legged. She said it had been many years since I'd not relied on some artificial crutch, either alcohol or sedatives. Sylvia stayed 2 weeks with Clarence and Dorothy Snyder in Cleveland. Clarence's Snyder's story is in the big book, The Home Brewmeister. She met Dr. Bob, who brought other men to meet her. Dorothy Snyder said that the men were only too willing to meet and talk with her after they saw her. Sylvia was a glamorous divorcee, extremely good-looking and rich. She was getting $600 a month alimony from her husband. It made her look good. But those attractions probably did not help her with the wives of the alcoholics who were known on occasion to run women out. They were vicious. After meeting Dr. Bob, she wanted to move to Akron, but this caused great concern since her presence there threatened to disrupt the whole group. Even Dr. Bob was uncomfortable with her being there. So she went back to Chicago, drank on the train, and finally got sober and worked closely with Earl Treat, who became her sponsor. There weren't any women, so he had to have a man sponsor. Her personal secretary, Grace Coltus, became the first secretary at the intergroup office in Chicago, the first in the country. By the latter, I've also heard Cleveland claim the same thing. The latter part of September 1939, they had a nucleus of six and held their first official group meeting. Sylvia said, by 1955, our membership in the Chicago area alone had grown from six members to 6,000. Now there were many to carry on the work. The group did not need us in the same degree as it had earlier, but our need for the group had not diminished. Sylvia said by 1955, our membership, there is no more aloneness with that awful ache so deep in the heart of every alcoholic that nothing before could ever reach it. That ache is gone and need never return again. We say to the new person, don't take our word for it. Instead, try it for yourself. Only then can you be sure that you've latched on to a design for living that can really work for you. Now there's a sense of belonging, of being wanted and needed and loved. In return for a bottle and a hangover, we have been given the keys of the kingdom. Yes. Sylvia Kaufman died on October 31st, 1974. How many do we have from Akron here today? No, we got one. And then we got Bob. Okay, this country lady grabbed hold of the program and gave herself to many. From Farm to City, Ethel Macy, Akron, Ohio, page 261 in the second and third editions. Let's hear what Ethel has to say. There you go. Thank you. That was a little hard to hear. Well, thanks for listening anyway. Okay, thank you, Ethel, for that. And she tells how AA works when the going is rough. A pioneer woman member of AA's first group. Ethel's date of sobriety was May 8th, 1941. She was the first woman to get sober in Akron. She was the oldest in a very poor family of seven. Her father was an alcoholic. I can really identify with Ethel. She moved from country to the city when she was at an age when the girls want to have nice things and want to be like the other girls at school. She felt that the others were making fun of her and feared that she wasn't dressed as well as the rest. At the age of 16, she was invited to spend her summer with an aunt in Liberty, Indiana. Her aunt told her that she could have boyfriends visit, but there was one boy that she must stay away from. That was Russ Macy. He came from a fine family, but drank too much. 4 months later, she married him. Fancy that. Even though he drank and was 7 years her senior. She was sure his family disapproved of her because she was from the wrong side of the tracks. They had two daughters, but about 7 or 8 years after they were married, his drinking became so bad that she took the children and went home. Ethel said, "I was still bitter because I found that drink had completely ruined my childhood and my married life, and I hated everything pertaining to it, and I was about 25 then, had never touched a drop." She didn't see Russ or hear from him for a year. At the end of the year, the children received a card from the father, which she kept and cherished. It said, "Tell Mommy I still love her." Soon, Russ himself arrived, and she welcomed him with open arms, though he had a little bit of pair of spurs and a safety valve and the clothes on his back. He told her that he would never drink again, as she believed him. He got a job and went back to work and stayed dry for 13 years. By the end of the 13 years, the older daughter was married, and she and her husband were living with them, and the other daughter was in her last year of high school. One night, the son-in-law and Russ went to a prize fight. Russ came home drunk, climbing up the stairs on his hands and knees. She told them, "The children are raised, and if this is the way you want it, this is the way we'll have it. Where you go, I'll go. What you drink, I'll drink." And then thus Ethel started drinking. They went on to vacations in the car, drinking all the way, and Ethel did the driving. One Sunday afternoon, she got picked up for drunk driving, and they were both thrown in jail. Ethel got indignant and told Russ, "Can you imagine them giving us that jail fare? They brought me a pitcher of coffee and a sandwich and all wrapped up for me." And Russ told her that wasn't jail fare. They didn't give me anything to eat. On another occasion, she got drunk and set the house on fire so it wouldn't have to paint it. God made sense to me. Ethel got upset with the religious neighbors down the street, and they used a sound truck to stop out there in front of the house, and they'd sit out there and they'd play these hymns. I'd be lying there on this bed with a god-awful hangover, and if I'd had a gun, I'd shot the horns right off that thing. It made me so raving mad. In 1940, they read something about AA in the newspaper. She talked about it and thought there might come a time when they might need it. A man at the bar told her, they roll on the floor and they holler and they pull her hair. She said, "Well, I'm nuts enough now." And her hope died. She was having a drink in the bar room one day. She told the woman behind the bar that she wished she'd never take another drink. And Ethel told her that she was licked and wanted help. "I thought, doesn't matter how crazy they are, I'll do anything they say to do." She was told to talk to Jack, the owner of the place, whom they had always tried to buy a drink, but was always refused, saying that he could not handle alcohol. This may have been John Munier, one of the early Cleveland members. Finally, one morning, Ethel got in the car and cried all the way to the bar, told him that she was licked and wanted help. But Jack was out, and his wife said that she had sent him over as soon as he returned. He soon arrived with two cans of beer, one for Ethel and one for Russ. And that was their last drink. Men from AA started coming to the house the next day telling their stories. And Jack brought them the Saturday Evening Post office story about AA. He told them the whole thing was based on the Sermon on the Mount and asked if they had a Bible. Coming off a drunk, it was hard to read the small print of that little testament that the bulldog had chewed up. But Russ said, "Mother, if this tells us how to do it, you'll have to read it. It was important for us to do the things that we were told." Paul Stanley, Historia's Truth Freed Me, in the first edition, visited and stressed that they read the book. So many nicely dressed people were coming to our house in nice cars that Ethel told Russ, "I suppose the neighbors say, now those old fools must have up and died, but where's the hearse?" Jack took them to a meeting at King's School on Wednesday night and introduced Ethel to some of the wives. How many of you have been to that King's School meeting? Isn't that fantastic? How many of you are going? All right. One was Annabelle Gillum, the wives of Wellie Gillum. His story was fired again in the first edition, and Annabelle was told to take her under her wing. And Ethel never forgot how Annabelle sort of curled up her nose and said, "They tell me you drink too." Ethel often thought how that would turn some people away, but she replied, "Well, sure, that's what I'm here for." Women had a harder time being accepted in Akron than they did in New York. Perhaps the reason Ethel was accepted was that Russ joined at the same time. Also, Ethel weighed 300 pounds. And the wives probably didn't consider her a threat. Now, her husband was about half her weight and about 5'2". They called him the pencil. Ethel gave a lot of credit to Dr. Bob and Ann for their recovery. The Smiths spent at least an evening a week at the Macy's home. And Russ thought that Dr. Bob thoroughly enjoyed them. She and Russ worked as a team and were very active from the beginning. Ethel started what may have been the first women's AA group. Russ died on Monday, September 4th, 1944, and was buried on Friday. AAs had invited Ethel to dinner the following Sunday. But first Ethel went to talk to women at St. Thomas Hospital. She recalled, I sat down on the side of one of their beds, and I started to weep. I couldn't stop. I was so startled, and I apologized again and again for it. And that woman told me that long after that this was the surest proof that this program would work. If on Sunday I could be there trying to think of something that would help her with this problem, then we must have something that could work. After Russ's death, Ethel's whole life was AA, and she sponsored many women. I have Carol. In Ethel's parting words, AA has changed, but the root of it hasn't. We're older in AA and we're older in years. It's only natural that we don't have the capacity to change, but we ought not criticize those who have. Ethel Macy died on April 9th, 1963, and I hope when you go to Akron, you get a chance to visit Ethel's grave. She's buried right beside Russ. This Southern lady was the first person to get sober in Dallas and started meetings there. Anybody from Dallas? Fantastic. This is Esther Ilizardi, Flower of the South, Houston, Texas. Her story was on page 343 in the second edition, 384 in the third edition. Esther's date of sobriety was May 16, 1941. She's a very attractive woman, full of pep. She was raised in New Orleans, where social drinking was acceptable. At home, they always had wine with dinner and cordials after dinner, and she attended cocktail parties, dances, and nightclubs. The first time she realized what alcohol could do for her was at her own wedding. She was so afraid that everything wouldn't be perfect that she became very nervous and was in a real terrific state when her father said, Miss Esther is about to faint. Get her something to drink. Oh, Esther wrote, Emma and the servant came back with a water glass full of bourbon and made me drink it down. That bourbon hit as I walked down that aisle, and I walked down that aisle just like Mae West in her prime, and I wanted to do it all over again. From that day on, she used alcohol to ease social situations and didn't know when she crossed the line into alcoholism. She divorced her husband after 7 years and went home to her parents, but couldn't stand living with them and went back to Texas and remarried the ex-husband. Then they moved to Oklahoma. In Esther's words, that's when all the boys and Esther got drunk and the wives didn't. The drinking got worse. Her husband would come home day after day to find her passed out. She was sent to a mental hospital where they kept her for 17 days. When they moved to Houston, the drinking continued. And she went out one day to walk her Cocker Spaniel. Patrol car passed and saw her staggering and stopped to take her home. But she got sassy with him, so he took the dog home and poor Esther to jail. Esther said, I don't like being fenced in with those bars. You don't get hotel service. I remember going back on that bunk and crying my eyes out. I think that's when I hit bottom. She was only in there for a few hours when her husband came to get her with a look of disgust on his face. She was complaining about being in jail and how she was going to sue the city for what they had done to her. He told her, remember, Esther, you're in jail, not at home. He read a story about AA in the Saturday Evening Post a few weeks before and finally showed it to her with the ultimatum. If you will do this thing, I'll go along with you, and if you don't, you will have to go home. I cannot sit by here and watch you destroy yourself. She wrote to the Alcoholic Foundation office in New York. She said, I was shaking so. I asked my husband to write the letter for me, but he said no. This was something I'd have to do all by myself. Within a week, a letter came back with AA literature. It was a routine letter they sent to everyone, but it was a handwritten letter from Ruth Hawk, AA's non-alcoholic secretary. That personal touch did a lot to help Esther. The letter stated that this man would come to see her. There weren't any women. That man was in the hospital, so she drank for 5 more days before coming into AA the following week. She called that her spill into AA. Esther was full of gratitude to her husband and 2 AA members who paved the way for her. During her second year in AA, they were transferred to Dallas and started an AA group there in 1943. The phone number in Dallas that Ruth Hawk had given her had been disconnected when she arrived, but unfazed, she started seeking out other alcoholics to 12-step. She said, "I threw myself into that 12-step work, and what I feared to be a calamity turned out to be the most blessed of blessings. I know that I must work for it as long as I live. I know that it's only by working it as long as I can stay sober and have a happy life. And that's the only way I can do it. Just keep keeping on, giving it away. It's an endless career. It's a way of life that pays as it goes every step of the way in compensations that have been wonderfully rich and rewarding." Esther ended her story with, "Dr. Bob says love and service keeps us dry." And Bill says, "Always must remember that our first duty is face-to-face help for the alcoholic who still suffers." Dr. Bob tells us about keeping it simple, not to louse it up. "I feel there is no situation too difficult, none too desperate, no unhappiness too great to be overcome in this great fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous." Esther had lived in Dallas from 1927 to 1932, and according to a letter she wrote to Bobby Berger in New York, dated March 29th, 1943, saying, "This is where I'd been so sick for 5 years, where I'd started trying out all the doctors, hospitals and cures, sanitarium 3 times, so I've lots to do. First off, four doctors to call on and let them look over me, Exhibit A. My minister has 2 prospects for us. He tried so hard to help me during those 4 years, and I had never heard of AA. She added, "I hope I have much AA to report in my next letter. You'll be hearing from me." They did indeed. A week later, April 5th, she wrote, "Dear Bobby, Margaret R. Berger, AA's national secretary at the time, and thank you, Gary, for this information. The new Dallas group met for their first time last night. 3 inactive alcoholics, 1 active from Detroit, and 2 non-alcoholics who brought the active one. They met for some time in Esther's home." Esther speaks to us. You need help?
My name is Esther. That's my daughter. With that, now we're here yesterday. But I know this. There's no way that I can never pay my bond. To remember always what I was like 12 years ago this weekend. I am just like we all over the time. But at least I know where I am, and if I continue to do what I have done in the last 12 years,
much better.
I will stay sober till I die.
Thank you. Thank you, Esther. In her story, Esther said, "I wish I could tell you how AA works, but I don't know. I only know that it does if you desire it with your whole heart and without reservation." Esther died on June 3rd, 1960, with slightly more than 19 years of sobriety. Her copy of the Big Book, which is signed by Bill Wilson, is on display at the Dallas Central Office. I got to get that picture at the International Women's Conference. in Dallas. Yay. Our Last Lady was instrumental in getting The Grapevine published. Stars Don't Fall, Countess Felicia Gazitsky. Page 401 in the second edition, page 400 in the third edition. Felicia entered AA in 1943, but had several relapses her first year. Her date of sobriety was 1944. She was probably the sixth woman to get sober in New York. Felicia was born in 1905 in the family castle in Blansko, Blans, which is now part of the Czech Republic. She was the daughter of Count Josef Gazitsky, a fortune-hunting continental count from a noble Polish family, and Eleanor Medill Sissy Patterson, editor of the Washington Times. Her mother brought Felicia to America as an infant in 1908, and she never saw her father again. Marty Mann was her sponsor. Bill Wilson called Marty and said, I have a dame down here whose name I can't even pronounce, and I don't know what to do with her. Felicia believed that her alcoholic problem began long before she drank and sought several escapes. Her personality from the time she could remember anything was the perfect setup for an alcoholic career. She was always out of step with the world, with her family, with people in general, and she lived in a dream world. Until her early 30s, when her drinking became a problem, she lived in large houses with the servants, all the luxuries that she could possibly want. Prohibition meant nothing. Her family always bought the best, and the embassies were flowing, but she never felt she belonged. She wrote, a drink never gave me a normal, pleasant glow. Instead, it was like on the tap on the head with a small mallet. Five or six drinks, and I was terrific. The men danced with me at parties. I was full of careless chatter. I was so amusing, and I had friends. Felicia stated, I knew in my heart that I was unfit for the very things that I wanted most, a happy marriage, security, home, and love. She was married three times. First to Drew Pearson in 1925, the newspaperman she mentions in her story. Does anybody other than me remember Drew Pearson? Come on, there's got to be someone. Carol, yeah. And one in the back. Yay, I'm not alone. She met him again when she had been sober for 10 years and told him that she always... He told her that he always felt guilty because she became an alcoholic after the divorce, and she's able to explain that she would have become an alcoholic anyway because that she had been a sick person, unfit for marriage. She married Dudley DeLavigne in 1934, but was again divorced less than a year later. They both drank. She used her venomous tongue, and he used his fist. I know that one. Her third husband was John Kennedy Magruder, a landscape architect, whom she married in 1958, then divorced in 1964. He was the director of a men's recovery home in Virginia. Through each of her marriages and through several geographic cures in Europe, her drinking became more degrading. She wrote, imagine my surprise when I came to in Europe and discovered that I had brought myself along. Imagine that. And I began to hear and now to fear the answer to the question, what is the matter with me? By 1943, she had moved to New York and was living a bohemian life in the village. Felicia said the horrors of increasing hangovers occupied the entire day. Horrors with the nausea, the dry heaves, the rocking bed, and that nightmare-filled mind. I did not know that I had no power over alcohol, that I alone, unaided, could not stop. Felicia remarked that I was not beautiful or good as I had yearned to be. I was fat and bloated, dirty, unkempt, wore a man's raincoat turned inside out. My tweed suit, once a very good one, was now shapeless and baggy, had places worn in the elbows from leaning on the bar, and I just wanted to die. Felicia had the good fortune to find a new analyst, Dr. Ruth Fox. She said, I think now that God, in whom I did not believe, was looking after me. Perhaps it was he who sent my analyst to a psychiatrist meeting at which Bill Wilson spoke. Dr. Fox told her about AA and asked her to read the book. She finally encouraged Felicia to go to AA, to the AA Foundation office, which was down on the Wall Street District of New York, and talk to Bill Wilson. In Felicia's words, Bill was tall, gray-haired, with a kind of asymmetrical good looks and pleasant, easy manner that instilled confidence in the shaken and afraid. He was well-dressed, he was easygoing. I could see that he was not a quack or a fanatic. He said to me gently and simply, do you think that you are one of us? Bill arranged for her to meet Marty Mann, and I thought, aha, he's passing the buck. Now comes the questionnaire. An alcoholic cannot accept the news that he's an alcoholic unless there is a meaningful explanation given and an offer of help, such as you get in AA. AA had to stop my drinking first, then I was able to do something about me. Felicia recalled that Marty was late, and I felt like a gangster's mall about to be interviewed by the Salvation Army. The woman who answered the door at Marty's apartment was Marty's long-term companion, Priscilla Peck, a very glamorous art director at Vogue magazine. Felicia speaks of Priscilla in her story. It was Marty and Priscilla who took her to her first meeting. In those days, there was only one big meeting a week in New York. Priscilla assigned Felicia to look after Anne, a rowdy newcomer, whose idea of fun was to hit sailors and insult cops. She was so busy keeping after Anne and keeping her out of trouble and so scared that Anne would swing on her, she had her last two drinks that night. In her first year, Felicia says, I kicked Priscilla in the shins and got the lock changed on the desk because as secretary at the AA club, I didn't want the intergroup secretary interfering. And I took an older woman member out for lunch for the express purpose of informing her that she was a phony. She was a talented writer, and with Marty and Grape, and Priscilla helped to start the AA Grapevine. Felicia had sunk low, but had not lost everything, and was one of the reasons they started to talk about high-bottom drunks. She concluded her story with, AA taught me how not to drink, and on the 24-hour plan, taught me how to live. She wrote an update of her story for the November 1967 Grapevine. It was signed FM, New Canaan, Connecticut. In it, she said she was disappointed to learn that her story would be in the section labeled, They Stopped in Time. She thought she had sunk pretty low. Felicia died on February 26, 1999, at the age of 92, a few months after giving an extensive interview about her friend Marty Mann to Marty's biographers, Sally and David Brown. The stories from the first three editions of the Big Book can be found in the conference-approved book, Experience, Strength, and Hope. And I'm hoping our sales go up because of this talk. I hope you have enjoyed learning about these six incredible pioneer women of Alcoholics Anonymous as much as I have. Thank you for allowing me today to share this bit of our history with you, and I look forward to seeing you for part two. Thank you.
Absolutely fabulous.
Oh, thank you, Mike.
You want to do, Nancy, you want to come down and do some Q&A?
Sure.
Could one of the guys grab her chair for her, and we're going to come right down and...
Okay. I lost the pen there.
We'll do the next reading at the next presentation, okay. But I just wanted to help you down. One of the guys will grab a chair and grab your water bottle.